So Luke is famous for gilding the lily in his writings. And so you have an instance of that in this idyllic depiction of the early Jesus community, where everybody shared everything. It didn't happen that way, we can be sure, because later on you get this famous couple that hid the money, and so they were stuck dead because they didn't put it in the common pot. But what Luke is after, of course, has a theological base, namely that we measure ourselves, our reality, in terms of our possessions of whatever kind, and there are multiple kinds of and to the extent that we do that, we exclude other people. We draw borders and boundaries. And borders keep people in and keep people out. So you have to keep your head screwed on when you read this stuff. Especially with this weird thing from John. It doesn't sound weird because we've heard it so often. You know, the doubting Thomas has become a kind of piece of folklore. But it's, and I've said over and over again that Thomas is a mixed bag. I mean, it's clear that Thomas has gone through many hands. The whole last chapter, the 21st chapter of John, where you get, do you love me, do you love me, do you love me, Peter and Jesus talking together, was added later on. It's not part of the original gospel. And there are all kinds of evidences within the text itself of an editorial hand, or probably several hands, messing around, rearranging things, clarifying things. I love that notion of clarifying things. And even worse, this thing between Jesus and Thomas goes against what the gospel had already said, that anybody who believes because of signs or miracles is not really believing. So Jesus is said to contemn such people. So how do we get, how do we get from there to Thomas sticking his hand, which probably didn't happen, of course, or his fingers in Jesus' body? Now, here to the author, whoever he or she is. Some people think it was a woman who did this. So we should talk about the Gospel of Johanna, I suppose. That here we have precisely faith based on some kind of miraculous thing. A body with holes, But it raises, and the point that the author is making is very serious. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe. He's talking about us, folks. We have not seen, and yet we believe. And so it raises a further question. What does it mean to believe? What does it take to believe? What is faith in the first place? Why believe? I think that's a really good question. For years and years, I struggled with faith. All through the seminary, which is as good a test of faith as I could come up with. I mean, this is about as faithless an environment as I could conjure. All you had was law and order, do this, report this, don't report this, blah, 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 blah. Well, okay. So, in any case, it has the advantage, that experience of intensifying the nature of this question, why believe? People come to faith in a variety of ways, I think, at least in my experience. But it is, I think, a perennially useful question to say, why believe? Because why believe entails the answer, what is it I believe in? So, to wax autobiographical for a minute, why do I believe? There are certain experiences in my life, and I've never had a mystical experience. Let's be clear about that. Listening to music a couple of times, I had an out-of-body experience, but that's a whole different thing, which I don't have to go into. I can tell you fairly simply, there are events in one's life which are so lucid, so beyond doubt, that they point to some further reality, I think. And it's worked in a variety of quite different ways. There are some people who believe precisely because of an absence of evidence. I mean, it works this way. The world is a jungle. It's not an original thought, of course. The world is a jungle. And then you ask the question, should the world be a jungle? Is that what we're made for? To be red in tooth and claw with each other? So this is called apophatic faith. I believe because of the absence of love, the absence of justice, the absence of generosity. And there's something deep inside me that says, it should not be. This should not be. I refuse to accept this as the normal destiny of us human beings. And I think a lot of faith, certainly for me, is of that apophatic variety. It is a protest against the status quo. And of course, that's very biblical, because you have this passage in the first letter of John. Faith is a struggle. Faith is a struggle. Faith is not something that falls down from heaven on your head and is, oh, that's good, that's all set up. Faith is a struggle. It is a victory. Over what? Over all the countervailing evidence. You say, this cannot be. But then there are other kinds of moments in my life which take on a kind of privileged place in my experience. I'll just give you one. And there haven't been many, I must say that too. Because faith is still a struggle. Still a struggle for me right now. Thomas Merton talked about faith being a struggle for him to the day he died, just about. Just profoundly. Deeply religious man. There was an evening in the seminary, shortly before we were all let loose at the end of the year, by breaking the law, our holy rule, had a party. You don't have parties in the seminary. But I had been directing the orchestra, such as it was, three kazoos, a vacuum cleaner, and a comb. You know, and so we had, well, I had been doing it for 4 years. And it was a privileged position because there were people from all 7 years in the orchestra. Normally you were not to talk to anybody outside your own year. There I was in this privileged position, and I came to this only very slowly, I want to insist. But the last concert we ever had, I somehow, and I still don't know how I did it, I got to a phone, because we didn't have phones either, and certainly not all these little gadgets that everybody carries around and is attached to today. I ordered cake and pop for the orchestra. See, the seminary regimen was this. After any event in the auditorium, movies, we had this few movies, always about submarines, because there are no women in submarines, as we all know. But then you're supposed to pack up and go home, go to bed. And that was the end of it. But this evening, I broke the holy rule and paid dearly for it, as it turned out, and had a party for the 35 or 40 people in the orchestra. So all these people who did not communicate with each other normally, all 7 years, you know, spread out all over. And there were so many, we couldn't get them all in one place. So some were in the basement, some were on the stage. And I just kept walking back and forth. And it was a miracle. Because I saw all these people who barely knew each other, many of them barely knew each other, listening to each other, speaking openly to each other, unafraid. unwilling to hide. I've never had anything like it since in my life. Not even here with all you guys. It was astonishing. It was astonishing. And then it dawned on me. My God, this is the kingdom of God. This is the kingdom of God. This is what Jesus was all about. You know? And so that memory juxtaposed against many, many counter memories. Yeah. So it was paradigmatic for my life.